Welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. I'm Joel Katz, and joining me this week, Dr. Brian Jankowitz, Associate Professor of Neurosurgery and Co-Chair of the Stroke and Neurovascular Service at JFK University Medical Center. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you. I know you're relatively new there at JFK. Tell us how you ended up there.
I certainly am. I'm about 6 weeks into the job, and I have to say I feel honored to be here. I grew up in Maryland, college at Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana, Temple Medical School, so I know the Philadelphia and Mid-Atlantic area very well. Matriculated into the neurosurgical residency at the University of Pittsburgh, and then came to the back east where my wife and I have settled in South Jersey. Always looking to join a medical center within the state, and Hackensack is at JFK is where we ended up.
Yeah, you got a good one.
I think we did.
I think they got a good one too, from what I've heard about you. Now, you deal primarily with the brain and the spine, correct?
I focus on all things related to blood vessels, and while okay. I was formally trained as a neurosurgeon to treat both the brain and the spine, and brain tumors and blood vessels and functional disorders, I absolutely fell in love with treating blood vessels during the end of my residency. And I've really focused for the last 13 years on all things related to arteries and veins of the head and neck. And while some of those diseases do evolve in the spine, my main focus are the arteries and brains of the head.
Okay, so what are an example of some of those things that you would focus on, most common things?
Sure. So I consider myself a stroke doctor. So okay. Anything that affects the blood vessels in the brain can commonly cause a stroke. And there are two flavors of a stroke. Ischemic, where you block a blood vessel. You have an occlusion of a blood vessel to the brain and you're not getting enough blood flow. Or a hemorrhagic stroke, where the blood vessel leaks or ruptures and causes bleeding in the brain. A hemorrhagic stroke might be caused by a ruptured aneurysm or a ruptured AVM or a cavernous malformation or a dural AV fistula or even a spontaneous bleed in the brain from leaky blood vessels. An ischemic stroke, on the other hand, is the polar opposite. Something causes an occlusion in the brain. So I'm a brain plumber. I open up clogged blood vessels most every day, and those clogs can come from the brain itself or they can embolize from the legs, mm-hmm. from the abdomen, or from the heart.
So when it comes to a stroke, and let's say something that's going on in the brain, is that something that we could see in advance to prevent?
That's an excellent question. Stroke is one of the top five causes of death in the United States, and actually one of the top three causes of death worldwide. So I am hoping that we are on the downslope in the United States, and I'd like to believe a lot of that has come from the acute treatment we provide, which is absolutely saving lives for people that otherwise might have died from massive strokes. But probably the greatest benefit we're providing is simply education, is getting word out about how to avoid strokes, and it's all the common things that we know we should do to protect our blood vessels. Don't smoke. Eat mm-hmm. real food, mostly plants, and then see your PCP once a year to keep an eye on your blood pressure, cholesterol, and serum glucose. And then also getting the word out about the signs and symptoms of a stroke. A gaze deviation, slurred speech, weakness on one side of the body, or an acute onset, severe headache associated with nausea and vomiting. These are the red flags that we want mm-hmm. people to seek help with on an emergency basis.
Well, other than the symptoms, are there any way that can it be from some sort of examination we can predict it or we could see it coming and to prevent it? Any type of test? No, okay.
I wish there were, but a stroke, it might be akin to the silent killer of hypertension or high blood pressure. Most ischemic strokes are painless, and certainly the development of blood vessel disease over time is often painless. You don't have the claudication of peripheral vascular disease, or you don't have the angina of chest pain from progressive occlusion of coronary arteries. When you slowly cause ischemia or lack of blood flow to the brain, it is painless and silent. So it's all about preventative maintenance to keep your blood vessels healthy, and then being able to diagnose the stroke the moment of onset, because we do know that time is brain, and patients need to get to the closest medical center that can adequately mm-hmm. deal with a stroke. And I do believe that JFK is as good a, or as great a hospital as I've ever seen that can immediately treat, recognize and triage a stroke as it's happening.
Now, you mentioned it's painless. Are you referring to, I mean, I know you're referring to leading up to the stroke, right? The symptoms are painless, correct? But
even an acute ischemic stroke, so there, as I said, there are two flavors. A hemorrhagic stroke is only about 10 to 15% of all the strokes that that occur in the U.S. By far, the majority are due to blocked blood vessels. Okay. And when you have that blocked blood vessel, unfortunately, you do not develop a headache or pain the way that that chest pain from a myocardial infarction will cause you to seek help. So many people are in denial. They might recognize they have a problem, but they don't seek help because pain is usually the great motivator.
Right.
So it's all about education and causing a new generation of physicians in the field to help recognize the signs and symptoms and get these patients to the closest place that can help.
Is there pain during the stroke?
No. No, unfortunately, there's not. For your classic bread and butter stroke, there is not.
Okay. And what is it, just kind of paralyzing?
Paralyzing, absence of speech, the inability to recognize speech. Sometimes you might develop severe dizziness or vertigo. The room may spin. Or your eyes, you might have double vision or the inability to move your eyes together in one synchronous movement.
Okay. Let's talk about the way you would collaborate between the collaboration between neurology, neurosurgery, critical care, the interventional as well. Let me ask you this. Are all neurologists neurosurgeons?
No. I'm so glad you asked, because I think JFK has one of the most collaborative neuroscience practices that I've ever had the privilege to work with. And as you point out, it takes an army. It takes neurosurgery to do the open, sort of maximally invasive cases when people are in extreme duress. It takes interventional neurologists to do some of the endovascular work to clean the pipes from the inside out, but also to be the primary doctor that recognizes and diagnoses the disease. Mm-hmm. And then it takes neurocritical care to care for those patients in the acute setting. And then finally, an excellent stroke-oriented rehab to care for these patients on the back end. Because in reality, I interface with a patient for a very small percentage of the entire disease process, but 90% of that is on the back end in rehab. And we are lucky to have what I think is the premier stroke rehab center in the state of New Jersey attached directly to my hospital. So I can treat a patient, go see them in the ICU, see them on the floor, and then days to weeks later, round them right in the ICU. That continuity of care is absolutely essential to having the best possible outcomes.
So you're with them the whole way?
I will hold their hand the entire way because, mm-hmm. quite honestly, it's extremely self-serving. To watch the progression and the recovery of these patients is just makes the world go round.
Talking with Dr. Brian Jankowicz, Associate Professor of Neurosurgery and Co-Chair of the Stroke and Neurovascular Service at JFK University Medical Center. So if I have a stroke and I'm brought to JFK, how's the process go? You're not waiting for me at the door. How does it go down? I go to the emergency room, and then at what point am I going to get to you?
So it most certainly the triage happens well before the patient reaches the emergency room, because I want to be on site the moment the patient arrives.
Okay.
So the moment, and we have, I think, also one of the strongest pre-hospital systems or EMS systems in the state of New Jersey, who are exquisitely trained to recognize the signs of a stroke. So as soon as the pre-hospital providers, the EMS technicians that are out in the field that are seeing these patients in their home, think that someone's having a stroke, the call is immediately made, and we're notified well in advance, so that way we can activate our team, and with the ability of social media and communication apps all on our phone to communicate with everybody at the same time, basically to work in parallel. So as the EMS driver is triaging the patient, we can notify the hospital system to get my entire team ready so we can meet them at the door. Sometimes we're wrong. Sometimes it's a stroke mimic, something like a seizure or a drug intoxication. But we're getting pretty good at recognizing the true signs of a stroke, so we are there, ready, waiting to do whatever is necessary, whether that's just observe the patient in the ICU or give a clot-busting drug like TNK, or taking them to the interventional suite where I can go up from the inside out, clean out their blood vessels, and restore blood flow.
But as you said, when the ambulance gets there, that's when it starts. It isn't just like a taxi ride to the hospital and then they're taken care of. It starts as soon as they get to the door.
It most certainly does. And once again, even in the ambulance, these simple things like oxygen and blood pressure control are essential. But as soon as they get to the ER, yeah, then it's game on. And I have to say, one thing that we do that I find especially endearing and helpful for patients is oftentimes we know we have a strong suspicion of what's going on. We don't really need an extended stay in the ER. So we have a system in place where the patients can effectively bypass the emergency room and come straight to our angio suite to get the most effective therapy to open up clogged blood vessels without wasting time.
Okay, so they're in the ambulance. They're taken care of at the door, and they get to the location that you just spoke of. And then from there, where do they go?
So as soon as they arrive at the door, if they have not had any blood vessel imaging, they go directly to CAT scan. We don't skip a beat. We don't waste any time. And that's where we learn if the patient has a brain bleed versus an ischemic stroke or a clogged blood vessel. And then directly from CAT scan to my home, my interventional angiography suite, where we can perform literally magic. We can open up occluded blood vessels and restore function that would otherwise be gone forever.
And the quicker the better with a stroke. You can lose
for sure. So
yeah, you lose function for life.
In theory, you lose about 2 million neurons for every extra minute of delayed time until you open up that occluded blood vessel. So time is legitimately brain, and we're attuned to that. So we are ready. We are ready to drop everything to make this happen, 24/7, 365.
So you say 2 million neurons per minute.
Yep, that is what's happening during an active stroke. You're losing that many neurons, mm-hmm. and that's why I personally make sure that I live within minutes of the hospital. That our team has metrics of being able to get to the scene within a certain amount of time. Everything is focused on the minutes that matter.
Can you just give us an idea of what 2 million neurons means? And I don't know how many neurons I would have. So, in the grand scheme.
You are lucky to have trillions of neurons.
Okay.
The problem is that there is low price real estate and high price real estate in the head. So you can lose 2 million neurons in the highest price real estate of the brain, let's say the brain stem, and you can have an irrevocable stroke. You can be locked in, as it were, where you have no movement or function below the neck, although your brain is functioning, or the reverse. You are literally brain dead with a functioning body. So sadly, it's hard to predict what 2 million neurons will mean to somebody. So we treat them all the same. Every neuron matters. So the goal is, once again, just to restore function mm-hmm. to every neuron possible.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, I know you focus, have clinical trials there at JFK, and hopefully you're always trying to develop new ways to, you know, to make people better. Tell us about how that works at the hospital.
Yeah, we most certainly are. I entered this field because I felt there were more unanswered questions about the brain and what we can do to offer therapy to it than any other field. And I truly think that interventional neuroradiology or interventional neurology or an endovascular neurosurgery, all three are effectively the same, is advancing faster than any other field. It was interventional cardiology a decade ago, but this is the decade of interventional endovascular treatment of the brain. And the only way to really be on the cutting edge is to enroll in clinical trials. And that's something that JFK has always had a very strong role in doing within the state of New Jersey. I also have had the honor of being the national primary investigator on a number of trials, including three that will be up and running within the next, hopefully, year or two that will be able to enroll at JFK. To really offer new devices that can help pluck clots out of brain, basically open up clogged pipes within the brain, and new devices that can evacuate hematomas or blood in the brain, something that I think is really going to advance over the next decade. This decade was the years of opening up occluded blood vessels. I think the next great leap will be evacuating blood that's accumulating in the brain from leaky blood vessels.
And creating devices that do that.
Exactly. Humbly, it is the devices that make all the difference. It is new technology that is driving this field forward, just like it changed the face of intracranial thrombectomy. All it took was one stent on a stick that was very effective in plucking clots out of the brain, and we are still looking for that in evacuating blood from the brain.
What are some of the devices that have already been or in development or have already been developed that we didn't have as little as a few years ago?
Yeah, there are two main advances in the way that we've been pulling clots out of brain. And clots are just soft accumulations of platelets and red blood cells akin to a small bit of putty. So we have large aspiration catheters, just big straws now, that can suck blood out of the brain or suck blood clots out of the brain. And the beauty of these straws is whereas before they were rigid and they were very difficult to get up deep into the brain, now they're made so supple, so smooth, so slippery that they can get all the way into the nether regions of the blood vessels to suck clots out. Two, we have developed stents on a stick. The cardiologist showed us that stents can crush clots against the blood vessel wall, but you'd have to leave the stent in the blood vessel.
Mm-hmm.
Now we basically put a fishing line on that stent, deploy it, and then reel it back, and clots love to stick to these stents. So those two methods of removing blood clots have revolutionized what we do. And it's actually amusing to see that now the other fields are learning from us. So the cardiologist taught us an immense amount, and now we're teaching them back, and we're teaching the peripheral vascular surgeons to use some of these devices and techniques. Because a blood vessel is a blood vessel, and you can use these techniques wherever you develop clots.
Dr. Brian Jankowicz, Associate Professor of Neurosurgery and Co-Chair of the Stroke and Neurovascular Service at JFK University Medical Center. So that's interesting. So you're saying that in the past, the stent would be placed inside the patient. Now the stent is just temporarily in there, moving around, gathering up whatever needs to be removed, and then pulled out.
That's exactly right.
Wow. Now, see, I thought a stent was something that would kind of like a pipe. You had something that either collapsed, like let's say a vein collapsed, so you would put something that's stronger in that spot, and that's what a stent was. Or is that another type of stent?
No, so you're spot on. And that is still what we do, let's say, for accumulated debris that over time occludes a blood vessel in the neck. We place carotid stents. I also can remove all of that with a carotid endarterectomy. So there is some benefit to having the ability to do open surgery and endovascular surgery. But in this instance, because those clots are so mobile and because they tend to stick to stents, you can attach them to that stent and then pluck it out. And that way you leave no foreign body behind, because we never want to leave a foreign material behind if we can help it. For instance, one of the new technologies is now bioresorbable stents that we can implant, and then over 6 to 12 weeks, the body will slowly resorb that material, leaving nothing behind but a clean blood vessel.
Kind of like a vanishing stitches or something like that.
Exactly, just like an absorbable stitch, but on the inside of a blood vessel. Remarkable.
And this wasn't available just a few short years ago.
It was not. That's why I love this field. I am constantly learning. I am in my 20th year of educational training. I am still a resident that is learning every day.
That is amazing. That's amazing. So what devices, we talked about newer devices, what are some devices that are on the horizon that we're unable to use yet, but we could see we're going to have this in the near future? Is that hard to predict?
I could have never predicted what I'm about to talk about, which is by placing sensors and electrodes on the same type of stents we were just talking about, we can now implant these stents within the brain at many different locations. And then these embedded sensors can pick up the electrical signal in the brain and recognize when there is a problem. Let's say that that sensor can recognize when a seizure is about to start or an active seizure, or it can recognize that the brain is not functioning as well, and it can then stimulate that area of the brain to improve or accelerate, let's say, motor recovery after a stroke. So this is getting into the field of functional neurosurgery, of effectively using electrical impulses that speak the language of the brain to change the function of the brain, all with embedded stents in the blood vessels of the brain. A whole new paradigm shift in what we considered endovascular neurosurgery or endovascular surgery from the past.
Now, let's go back to 20 years that you just mentioned. Let's go back to when you started 20 years ago. What is the one thing, and maybe it's what you just mentioned, what is the one thing that you are most amazed by, the technology, the advancement, whatever the case may be, that we've seen over the past 20 years that just blew you away? I'm sure a lot of them have, but what would be the one that really tops all the other ones?
Yeah, It is the explosion in technology that has allowed us to access the nether regions of the brain from the inside out. We knew that we could use open surgery to get to every nook and cranny of the brain, but often at the expense of that person. You have to move, resect, cut, or push on brain to get to these nether regions. But it just so happens that there's an intricate network of pathways to get to these places, and those are the arteries and veins that feed and take away blood from the brain. And now we can maneuver through those with longer, suppler, narrower tubes called catheters. And then that has really opened up the possibility of implanting electrodes or stimulators or sensors in the deepest, darkest regions of the brain. That has been the mundane leap in technology that has helped us open up these doors. I honestly don't know what's coming next with regards to what type of electrical stimulators that we're going to be able to place inside the cranium in these blood vessels, but we have the ability to implant them. So now it's a whole other set of computer engineers and electrical engineers that can figure out new devices that we can implant.
That's funny when you say it's the technology. I mean, technology itself has, over the past 20 years, just exploded, right? Because for 2,000 years, or almost, we didn't have, you know, the internet, right? And then where it's grown in the past 20 years, so much quicker than it did over the previous years. And it's kind of like the same thing that you're talking about with technology, you know, medically speaking.
Oh, and then you factor in ChatGPT and artificial intelligence. It is profoundly altering the way we practice and think about medicine. And quite frankly, there will be a time when computers and artificial intelligence can do much of what we do. But I think it's the creativity, the pure imaginative genius that has really led to the development of most of these devices that I think is gonna keep us in the game and keep this field vibrant and new for at least another decade.
Do you think that robotic surgery will become automatic? Like now, the doctor is still operating the procedure, but do you think there'll be a time where you just push a button? And the robot takes over and does whatever surgeries you perform now on a daily basis? Can you see that happening? I think I can, but you would be closer to it than I.
Yeah, I think that is certainly possible for the most simplistic procedures. Mm-hmm. What makes more sense to me is our cyborgs, effectively a hybrid human and robot that harness the best of what each has to offer. The creativity, the imagination, and dexterity of a human brain and a human fingertip combined with the precision and the unending endurance and lack of fatigue of a robot. I think when you combine the best of both worlds rather than thinking about it as man versus machine, that's where we're really going to see the best possible outcomes. And we see that now with things like the Da Vinci robot, with surgeons like our new head of surgery, Dr. Bora, performing robotic-assisted esophagectomies with the precision that no human could match, but with the dexterity and just mental flexibility that Dr. Bora brings to the table.
Right. And Dr. Bora's been on this program.
I don't doubt it. He has been a guiding light for me, and then one of the main reasons that I've come to this institution, because he also thinks, I think, very much, I'd say like a neurosurgeon, he might say like a general surgeon, but he has a vision of using technology to make us better. And that's something that I can get behind and look forward to collaborating with him about.
Yeah, you're not the first person to say that either.
Good. It is a well-deserved accolade for him. And I think that he will bring a vision to this institution that we can all get behind it and work towards a common goal of making JFK really one of the thought leaders either in the state of New Jersey or in the United States with regards to avant-garde therapy, harnessing and utilizing everything that possible to provide better outcomes for our patients.
Dr. Jankiewicz, thank you for your time.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Brian Jankiewicz, Associate Professor of Neurosurgery and Co-Chair of the Stroke and Neurovascular Service at JFK University Medical Center. For more information, you can go to jfkmc.org, or for a podcast of this show, you go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health is brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz, and we will talk again next week.